Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, the show that takes you inside the Texas and federal appellate systems. Through conversations with judges, court staff, top trial and appellate lawyers, academics, and innovators, we provide practical insights to help you become a more effective advocate. Whether you're handling appeals or preparing for trial, you'll discover strategies to sharpen your arguments, innovate your practice, and stay ahead of the latest developments. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Michael Duncan from Naiman Howell, Smith & Lee. He's in the Austin office of that firm. Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So a few weeks ago, we did an episode about the new Rule 166A in Texas trial practice, the summary judgment rule. And we thought we would do, now that that rule has been finalized, as of March 1, it is the official Rule 166A, with some changes that the Supreme Court made, as it typically does before it releases the final version, or before the rule becomes effective, I should say. And you've been writing some things on this and published, I thought, a really useful chart on LinkedIn that we're going to refer to at various points in the episode. Also going to make it available in our show notes for this episode because it is a great tool. We'll talk about it in some detail. But basically, back in episode 160, Jody and I sort of walked through the proposed rule and we flagged some concerns that jumped out at us that hopefully the Supreme Court would take into account and other people might comment on in advance of the comment deadline back at the end of February. And so our mission today is to take a look at the final version, effective March 1, to see what the Supreme Court did, if anything, with those concerns that we flagged. And then if there are any new issues that were created by the amendments that the court made to the proposed rule before putting it in final form, I think there may be a few to continue conversation about. We don't really intend to completely recap the previous episode. We wouldn't have time to do that. So we're going to refer folks back to what is episode 160, as I said. And then we're going to get into what's new in this episode today. And we're glad to have Mike, you with us here on the show to talk about that. Before we get into that, though, let's give you a chance to sort of introduce yourself and talk about your background and how you got into appellate practice and maybe specifically your interest in summary judgment.
Sure. Well, here at Naiman Howell, I practice mostly either appellate or motions practice. As a result, I end up doing a lot of summary judgment work. I've been interested in appellate practice, like many people, since law school. And when I graduated law school, I went to the Supreme Court and clerked for Justice Johnson for a year. And after that, I joined Naiman Howell. Ostensibly, I joined in corporate practice, but I was looking for every opportunity I could to scratch that appellate itch. So after a few appellate cases and possibly after my partner I was working for in the corporate practice realized I might be better at appellate law than I was at corporate law, he asked if I wanted to move more into that full time. And I had that opportunity. So that was great. Prior to that, I had a career in public affairs, representing ophthalmologists at the state legislature and before state agencies, not as an attorney, you know, a lay public affairs practice. And then after I'd done that for about 16 years, I had the opportunity to either move on to something bigger or finally go to law school, as I'd thought about doing for so long. Went to law school as a 40-year-old 1L. So that's how I ended up here.
I'm sure that life experience and particularly experience in the legislature benefited you as a lawyer, though, and starting in law school, but going all the way through into your current career.
It definitely did, though I got to say it was extremely enjoyable to disconnect from real life for 3 years and hang out with a bunch of very young, very smart people.
Well, great. Well, we're glad to have you with us today, and then you bring an interesting perspective to the issues we're going to be talking about. So I just want to jump in then, you know, we're going to first cover the things that we think the court fixed in the final rule that we had pointed out in our last episode. The first was there was ambiguity in the burden of proof on a traditional motion and what it applied to. The proposed rule could have been read to bar traditional motions for summary judgment on an opponent's affirmative defenses because it included this language an issue on which the movement would have the burden of proof at trial, and also a genuine issue of material fact exists as to a claim or defense. I'm trying to remember, Jody, exactly what we thought created that ambiguity.
Well, because it said a genuine issue of material fact exists as to a claim or defense on which the movement would have the burden of proof at trial, which you could read that to mean not just defense, but claim. And it just was a little bit ambiguous as to whether or not that eliminated your ability to move on someone else's claims for which they had the burden of proof, particularly defenses.
And so now that we see that that ambiguity has been removed, the definition now reads, the movement seeks to establish that no genuine issue of material fact exists as to a claim or defense, and that the movement is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. That is clearer to me. And I also see that in describing the motion, it's, I believe, B1. It also clarifies that a party may move for summary judgment on a claim or defense. I think pretty simple. You can read these two provisions together to eliminate any ambiguity there. And so I think we don't have that problem. And gratefully, the court, I'm sure we weren't the only ones that posed this issue to the court. Jody, I know you sent in comments. Mike, did you send in comments, by the way?
I did not send any initial comments. I've sent comments to the new final rule.
Oh, well, I can't wait to hear about those. That's the good stuff. So in any event, I think where we, to loop back and sort of close the loop on this point, I think we're back to where we were under the former rule, which is you can move for summary judgment on either a claim or on an affirmative defense. There's not a gap there at this point. Jody, what point would you like to cover next on things the court fixed?
So the next one, I think we had talked before in the traditional motion section, didn't actually say that you had to provide evidence, which I guess on a no evidence summary judgment makes sense, but on a traditional motion kind of creates some issues because in the old rule, there were deadlines about when everything had to be filed, notices of hearing and all that. And I think it was just one of those kind of oversight things. And now B2C says specifically a traditional motion has to have evidence with it, which I think is good. And when in a few minutes, we'll talk more about what that evidence is because they became very explicit in the updated rule, which I think is good.
We flagged in the previous episode that the rule did not make clear whether parties could agree to extend response or reply deadlines. Now the rule closes that gap, and you had to get leave of court before, but now the final rule says, except on leave of court or agreement of the parties, and that's in sub D1 and E1. So I think now the court has made clear that yes, that the parties can reach agreement on extending certain deadlines. This is a very practical and significant fix for those of us that do summary judgment motions or responses on a regular basis, just because you face, you know, conflicting deadlines all the time in your practices. Mike, it looks like you have something to say about this.
I am sure that they heard not only from attorneys on this one, but probably from a few judges as well.
No, I think that's probably right, because I think we can all agree, you know, from a lawyer perspective, it's critical, but why would the court want to stand in the way if the parties agreed to alter some deadlines? And that's what Rule 11 is for, right? So I think that's a good change, and I'm glad, whatever the source, I'm glad that the court saw fit to make that adjustment.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we'll talk more in a minute, but this particular provision is the one that I worry the most about in the rules when we get to that. Not the agreement of the parties, but the overall provision. We'll get there.
Okay, sure.
And then I guess the next one that we had kind of flagged was in the original version, the response had to have the objections to the evidence supporting the motion as part of the contents of the response, which is interesting because that's, I guess I have done that before, but that's not always been my practice because you can file separate objections and do everything in its own thing. I don't know that I had a big problem with it other than I know that there's page limits and some local rules and things like that. And so you're already creating some problems for people with that. So I think it probably is good that the court just took that out.
Yeah, agreed. You didn't need to create a problem where there really wasn't one before. So it's nice to have that issue taken care of. So those are the major things that I saw that I think we've generally have agreed the court addressed in the new rule. Did I miss anything there? Or Mike, did you see anything that we didn't talk about?
Yeah, one thing they did add in the new rule is to provide that the clerk will serve notice of the hearing. Prior to that, while the court had to set the hearing, it wasn't necessarily clear how that was going to get communicated to the parties.
Yeah, there's another change to that I want to get to when we talk about the new issues in the final order that were created. I just want to quickly recap. I don't think we've got any more of the things that we pointed out. I don't think that there's any more that the court actually did fix, far as I can recall. There are a few things worth mentioning that we pointed out that the court did not fix. Not to say that the court, you know, should have listened to our every word and taken it as gospel. I mean, we went to the trouble to record the episode, but no. Hopefully the judges on the court all know that we don't take ourselves too seriously and definitely don't purport to be telling the court what it should do. It's tempting sometimes, but we have a lot of respect for the court, certainly as an institution, and the judges, the justices, and it's not our place to, you know, try and tell them what to do, but all we can really offer are friendly suggestions. And gratefully, as I said, whatever the source, it seems like some of those well and made those changes. But as far as the things that the court did not address in the new rule that we had pointed out and possibly others had too, this is just a minor issue, the terminology between a combined motion for summary judgment and a hybrid. You know, I mentioned last time around that you see in the case law all the time the word hybrid used when it's both a traditional and a no evidence motion. I don't really have a problem with choosing the word combined instead of hybrid. It just means that we're going to start seeing that reference in the case law as opposed to what is currently been or up to now been referred to as a hybrid motion. So just keep that in mind as you're reading cases, especially those that just starting practice, they won't be as familiar with all those old cases that have used hybrid for the last 30 years or so. Minor point, but worth flagging.
Well, and it especially comes up when you're trying to come up with your search terms for Westlaw or Lexis.
Good point. Yeah, good point. Jody, you were big on the potential for abuse of these in our last episode. Do you want to just reflect on that for another minute?
Sure. I mean, interested in Mike's take on this too, but I think my biggest concern with this rule, and I understand why, given the deadlines in the statute, but the fact that the plaintiff filing controls when the defendant's response is due rather than the hearing, that just bothers me. I guess the movement's filing controls when the non-movement's response is due, because I can see lawyers using that to strategically disadvantage their opponent. If they know their opponent's going to be busy, if they know they're going to be in a trial or whatever it is, you can file your summary judgment. The trial court then has to set it and hear it within a certain amount of time, and your response is due 21 days after they file it, and you have very little control over it unless, number one, they agree, or two, you get leave of court, which, you know, when you've only got 21 days and you're scrambling and all that, I don't know. I see some real potential for abuse there, or people just filing it to suss out what the other side has and then withdrawing their motion right before the hearing. I just think there's a lot of room for that. Mike, I'm curious on your take.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Well, I agree that there's some potential for abuse there, but I feel like some of that abuse could have been had in the past, particularly pulling it down before the hearing after seeing the evidence. That said, the similarities between the new rule and the federal, especially in the Northern District and the Southern District, where the deadlines are exactly the same, 21 days, 7 days, really will make this feel familiar to people who end up with a lot of federal court practice.
I think we covered that a little bit last time, too, that, you know, we've seen a little more federalization of our state appellate rules and trial court rules over time. This is just consistent with that, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point.
We shall see. I don't know. I mean, I suppose it won't be long before we start hearing war stories about that topic, if that's how litigators choose to use the new rule. The Supreme Court did not institute any, it didn't comment one way or the other on how it thought that should go. And so we will see what develops.
I think the trial judges are the ones that are going to kind of bear the brunt of it, really, because they're the ones who get the motion, then have to set it. Then they've got space on their docket now for this, and it may or may not get withdrawn. But maybe that's not any different than what's been happening, to Mike's point, all along. I don't know. We'll see. Appellate filing requires precision. A small mistake could derail your case. That's why you need Counsel Press, trusted by 100% of the Am Law 100 firms since 1938. Whether it's e-brief preparation, indexing, or electronic filing, they provide complete support, ensuring every document meets the highest standards of accuracy and compliance. Their dedicated team of appellate counsel and paralegal specialists guide your case through every step. From review to filing, Counsel Press has your back. Visit counselpress.com to learn how they can support your next appeal.
Well, I actually had flagged in here that something the court had not addressed, we wondered about in the last go round, was whether new evidence could be attached to a reply. It's true that I think maybe that's the incorrect take, because I think they've dealt with this indirectly. So, but just to clarify, you know, the rule itself only prohibits new or independent summary judgment grounds in a reply. And so that part of the rule addressing the reply specifically is still silent on new evidence, whereas the old 21-day notice period, you know, implicitly blocked late evidence. And so you could say, well, this is an open question. Do I get to attach new evidence to my reply that I didn't include with my motion? But if you look at subsection B2C on traditional motion, the court did add the language that it says a traditional motion must state specific grounds in support of the motion. There was a period there in the draft. The final rule says after what was the period and produce any evidence in support. So I think if you read the rule closely and sort of holistically, I think that does tell you that implicitly the time to present your evidence in support of your motion is when you file a motion. I think that's how the courts will read it anyway.
In addition to that, they've added to the very end of the rule, in accordance with other case law, how late filed evidence is treated. That certainly implies that evidence might be late filed.
Yeah, that's a great point. And late filed could be late that you didn't file it with your motion, I suppose. And then late filed that you're the respondent or the non-movement and you filed it after the period for filing your response. And so that could cover both of those scenarios, I guess, is what you're saying, Mike.
Be careful when you're drafting proposed orders, because if you just say the court considered the evidence of, you know, arguments of the parties and whatnot, you may inadvertently permit late filed evidence to be considered. So just think carefully about how you word that if you've got that issue.
That's right.
That's a good tip. I like to include the court considered timely filed evidence in my orders.
Yeah, that's a good drafting tip for sure. This is an interesting point, though, about the addition on late filed evidence. I think we'll get to this. We may want to discuss this a little later, but it did add, there's a whole new red line that adds that provision on late filed evidence that says the court may consider late filed evidence if the court indicates its consideration in the record. So that adds another twist to drafting, because it seems like in order for late filed evidence to be considered, the court has to acknowledge that it was late filed evidence and say that it considered it. So this is another thing that's just going to have to develop over time with, you know, people are going to have to draft their orders and those orders are going to have to go up on appeal and people are going to have to be arguing about, well, did the court consider late filed evidence or not? And then we'll see some references to this new subpart of the rule telling us, okay, what does the court have to do for that evidence to be considered or show that it wasn't considered? So getting down in the weeds, though, a little bit on drafting now, because we can hypothesize about what all this is going to do. But in the end, as we've said before on the show, you won't really know the answer until it percolates up on appeal. Well, and talked a little about discovery not otherwise on file, Jody, but is there more to say on that?
No, I think we just don't really know what it is. I guess one thing that is not entirely clear is discovery not on file. I mean, does that mean in the specific context of something that's not filed with the motion? Because now they've added the section that we can talk about more in a minute, that evidence is in the court's file someplace else can be used reference. So, I mean, when it says discovery not on file, does it mean specifically in the MSJ context or just anywhere in the court's file? I don't know. Something for people to figure out.
Mike, anytime you've got a comment on any of these, please chime in.
Yeah, jump in.
So I will say, if it's somewhere in the court's file, I don't believe that's what the rule refers to, because the immediate preceding rule states that evidence produced by reference can be specifically referred to by pointing out where it may be found in the court's file. So if it's in the court's file somewhere, I don't believe that would be evidence not otherwise on file.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's an important, an observation that comes out of that is, this is the three of us spitballing, trying to figure out what this means. And, you know, it's been out for about a week now, and so it's still hot off the press. You know, none of us have seen it in action yet. We are sort of speculating about how this is going to go. And I think if we sat down and did, you know, extensive analysis and research based on the facts we're dealing with in the record in a case that we are working on, you know, we might come to different conclusions, or we may be advocating different sides of this. You know, for today, we're speaking sort of objectively, trying to, and just pointing things out and hopefully being helpful to those that are going to be in that position of being advocates trying to apply the new rule. Last thing on things that the court didn't address, this wasn't in the proposed rule, but we did point out that there was some speculation. The advocate article that we spoke of in the last episode talked about this, is how in the world is the court going to track this? You know, are the parties going to have some obligation to keep up with these deadlines for ruling and so forth and remind the court? And I think we observed that that particular concern was not addressed in the draft rule. It was not addressed in the final rule either. So the compliance with the deadlines, as Mike, I think, suggested earlier, still really rests with the clerk and the trial court. And so there's not an official mechanism for the parties to flag an approaching deadline. But that still may fall within the range of best practices, depending on which side of the issue that you're on. You know, sending a letter to the court coordinator or something like that, if you know the clock's been ticking and the court hasn't taken any action, it seems like that might be a good idea to sort of help the court along, at least coordinate, talk to court staff maybe. Again, we haven't seen this in practice yet to really know how this is going to go. Anything else on the things that the court didn't address in the final version of the rule from you guys? All right, now we get to move to the fun stuff. And I know, Mike, you've got a thing or two to say on this topic, which is, you know, what new issues were created by the final order? Because as we talked about last time, the way this process works is there's not multiple rounds of comment period. It's one shot, and the court will take those comments from the proposed rule and roll them out into a final rule and adopt it, and that's it. Not to say that the rule wouldn't be changed or couldn't be changed later. It certainly could, especially if new issues pop up. And I want to hear, Mike, about, let's start off, why don't we, with what you were suggesting earlier, is you were going to comment, you had an intention to comment on the final rule and an issue that came up in your view based on the new version.
Yeah. So under the old rule, the timing for filing a response said that you may file a response 7 days before the hearing. The new rule says you must file, under the rule as published on December 30th, said you must file any response within 21 days of the filing of the motion itself. The new version that came out last week says you must file a response. And that implies to me that no longer is filing a response optional, as it always has been, but now it's required under the rule. That's not going to affect most attorneys. Most attorneys are going to file a response. I would really hope that all attorneys are going to file a response and not just roll the dice on the idea that the movement didn't prove its case. But that's something that we may see come up as appellate attorneys if we pick up a case we weren't involved in at trial level, no telling where it came from. It may have been a pro se client, for that matter, at the trial level, and they're trying to avoid a summary judgment that was granted against them.
I wonder what the consequence for that failure is here, because under the old rules, you didn't file a response, fine, so long as they didn't prove their case. The lack of a response was kind of immaterial because you can't get summary judgment by default effectively. I just wonder if someone doesn't do that now, what the problem is or what the conflict would be.
I would think that eventually it would still be the same outcome. There's no default summary judgment. However, you get the wrong judge at the trial level or you get the wrong panel at the appellate level, you know, you might be spending a lot of money to fight about it.
Right. So basically just don't ignore your response deadline is the key. Even if it's to say that they didn't meet their burden, do something.
I mean, you could file something that simple, basically, just to get something on file. I don't think you want to be the litigant that doesn't comply with the rule that says you must file a response. And obviously in the no evidence context, if you don't file a response, you're going to lose the motion.
Well, right. This is really only about traditional.
Yeah, it is. But yeah, that's an interesting change. I don't know what drove that part of it. It's good that they added the provision there on allowing an agreement of the parties to extend the time for the response, but adding or deleting any in favor of an A response, I'm not sure. Again, time will tell. Well, so there are some other changes kind of like that I think are worth mentioning kind of quickly. One is the court in the original version had sort of what we all know to be the standard of to get a motion for summary judgment on no evidence grounds granted. which is to show that the non-movement could not present evidence of one or more essential elements of its claim. And what the court did here is modified that one or more essential elements language in the definition of no evidence, of a no evidence motion, to an essential element. I really don't think that there's any intention, you know, the court has made clear it didn't intend to change the law. So I don't think there's an intention to change anything there. It could very well have been that the court was just trying to tighten up the language in the rule a little bit. But I can just see a lawyer creating or making an argument by attacking multiple elements that goes beyond the scope of what a no evidence motion is. Because, okay, well, the rule says you get to attack an essential element. Pick your essential element. That is not what this rule is intended to do. There's no way. I just don't know why the court even created the argument that somebody will make at some point.
Right. Well, to Mike's point, I mean, probably doesn't mean that, but it's going to cost a lot of money for somebody to find out one day.
Agreed. Agreed. And that's, you know, the whole point behind a no evidence motion is you're supposed to identify the specific elements you're challenging. By definition, you can challenge more than one element. You know, you could have a challenge to more than one. So, you know, I don't think anything significant is going to come out of that, but it's just an observational point. And I'll jump into the next one too, because it's kind of the same level. It really leads to some speculation, but not much more, I don't think. The proposed rule in subsection C, or in section C, the court must set the motion for an oral hearing or submission without an oral hearing. But the word promptly was immediately followed the court. The court must promptly set the motion was in the former version, and promptly has now been removed. So my only thought on this is that it's conceivable that a court within the bounds of when the motion has to be heard on submission or oral hearing or and decided, the court might decide not to set it so promptly and give you a really short amount of notice of your hearing. And depending on your availability and the usual factors that go into law practice, you might wind up kind of getting a surprise hearing in sort of late notice of that. I just see that as a potential risk. And one potential outcome of this as well, you know, the court waited till the end of the time period and then set a hearing, I presume, on like 3 days notice, which for a lot of folks, especially if you're out of town, you're not from the area in which the suit's been filed, you know, appearing at a hearing on 3 days notice can be tough. So just something to flag as being out there. I don't know that anything significant is going to come out of it or it's going to really change anything, but just something, you know, the court struck the word promptly. So that could conceivably have some effect.
And it would deprive you of some of your oral advocacy, possibly. But theoretically, given the nature of summary judgments, it shouldn't affect the outcome. Of course, it may, but it shouldn't. Not to mention, I would expect most courts that are having to hustle up with a 3-day notice, they're probably just setting it for submission and telling you, you'll hear from me in 90 days after that.
That's right.
That's probably the more likely scenario, Mike, is that a court says, oh, yeah, I got to do something with this. I'm going to set it for submission, you know, on 3 days notice.
And then they'll send out an order denying it, which is what I think you're going to see a lot more of, is a lot more denials.
That could very well be. And that's an interesting point. You know, what does that do to summary judgment practice as a whole? If you just see a whole bunch of orders denying, we've seen an uptick over 10 or 20 years in the number of summary judgments that courts have granted. It used to be that courts didn't like to grant summary judgments. You still hear that. So I think that's probably the uptick in granting of summary judgments is you would think would fall off as a result of the encouragement and the rules of courts just to, you know, I'm not going to have a hearing. I'm just going to deny it. We're going to move on. I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
That's a concern that has been expressly raised to me by some of my litigation partners, that they're concerned that all this rule does is encourage more denials. I'm hopeful that the 90 days that the judges have take it under consideration after the hearing or submission will give them enough time to avoid that. But it would be interesting if somebody did a study of summary judgment decisions to see how many of them get denied in the last day before 90
okay,
days
runs. Let's flag this for OCA right now.
There you go. Put this in your time charts that you're going to be reporting.
Yep. Let's add that criteria, add that unit of measurement is how quickly before the end of the period, the ruling period or court's ruling, and set, but even broader and think more importantly, what are we going to see in the next measurement cycle after courts start ruling on this in terms of the number of summary judgments being denied. That would be an interesting fact to take a look at when the stats are available.
So one of the things I saw just this week was a scheduling order that crossed my desk that said all dispositive motions needed to be filed about 60 days prior to trial and that they needed to be heard by 30 days prior to trial. I said, well, that's a problem now. We have a 35 to 60 day window for hearings. If we're going to have that window for hearings, we're going to give the courts more time with summary judgment filings. So it seems to me we need at least 90 to 120 days in scheduling orders when you're thinking about how to schedule out dispositive motion deadlines. But I'd be interested to hear what y'all thought about that.
I mean, yeah, I think that's consistent with what we talked about in the previous episode, that we thought as a general matter, scheduling orders were going to have to really, you know, build out the deadlines and give a lot of lead time for summary judgments. I mean, I don't think I have any different thought on that today.
I don't know that I do either, but I think it is something that you need to think about and keep in mind, particularly now that the setting of the hearing is a little bit out of the party's hands, honestly. You know, it used to be one party would file your summary judgment motion, you'd call, you'd get dates, you'd send out the notice, and now you file a motion and it kind of is removed from your control. So just be aware of the deadlines well in advance of when you think you might need to do it, just so you have that going in the background.
And I don't end up dealing with scheduling orders all that much in my practice. They usually come to me on the back end, long been set. And so it's something that I flagged as something to discuss with my litigation partners to make sure they know.
Yeah, I think that's the key, is just keep it. It may not be a big deal, but now that there's these deadlines and these requirements, just kind of keep them in mind, both when you're doing a scheduling order or when you're trying to comply with one that's already in place. And hopefully, I think as this gets more baked into Texas practice, judges may account for some of this stuff in their scheduling orders. You know, you have to file the motions by X date, which means the hearings will be by Y date, those types of things. But for now, I think we probably still have a lot of the standard templates.
For most clients, supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime. What's at stake can be very significant. Very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds, so it's important to work with a company that knows the ins and outs of the process. If you have a client needing to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, contact Court Surety Bond Agency today. Another issue just worth talking about briefly about responses is it does clarify, I mean, I think this was already the intent, they just changed some of the wording, that you got to submit your evidence with the response. We talked about the change and they removed the language requiring the objections to be made in the response already. And I can't recall if we addressed this already. I don't think we did, but the original version said, oh, and by the way, ask for a hearing in the cover of your motion when you file your response. And I think one of the things we observed last time was, well, you don't typically have a cover to a summary judgment motion, unlike an appellate brief. The court changed that to read, assert the request or make the request in the title of your response. So that simplifies it, doesn't impose a requirement that we have to add a cover to our summary judgment motions. But the thing I wanted to get to here was that the draft had a sentence that said, the court may reset the motion for a hearing if no hearing has been set. And it deleted that language entirely. And so I'm not really sure the impact of that. It almost, looking at it now, it doesn't even seem like that language even belonged here. And now they've removed it. So I'm trying to read the tea leaves to figure out what they were getting at. And I'm really not sure, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm not sure how you reset a motion for hearing if it hasn't been set in the first place.
Well, not only that, but what does that really have to do? I mean, you're asking, it has to do with the request for a hearing and the response, but yeah, it hasn't been reset, so I don't know. I guess all this is to say, hey, that seems like a good change, a good deletion, because it whatever confusion may have been caused by the inclusion of that language has now been addressed by just removing it.
Just going to the sentence before that about putting the request for oral argument in the title, I think that also ties in pretty well with the timing requirement for the hearing, in that the court may have up to 90 days for the hearing if its docket requires it or on good cause, or if it's requested by the movement. or agreed to by the movement, rather. And therefore, if you're the movement and you want an oral argument, you should probably put in your title, oral argument requested, and movement agrees to 90-day hearing timeline.
I know that's something you mentioned in your cheat sheet that we're going to talk about, Mike. That is a great practical tip for sure. But I do want to get to that. Do you want to talk, Jody, about the amended pleading exception? Because there is some new language there that I think is worth noting.
Yeah, I mean, the old rule made pretty clear that you can't raise new or independent summary judgment grounds in the reply, but you are allowed to address new or amended pleadings filed after the motion. But they've added a clause to that, that it's only those new pleadings filed after the motion if a ground initially asserted in the motion negates an element that is common to a claim or defense asserted in the new or amended pleading. So it's got a, your original argument still kind of has to tie back to whatever the new claim is. I'm not quite sure how practically that's all going to work, but it's just something to be aware of, that you've got to have some connection, I think, between your original motion and then what's in the amended pleading to be able to address that.
So I will say, places that I've seen something like this come up before, and I believe the new language is consistent with some case law on this. But for example, if you've got a case that involves a negligence claim and the amended pleading, because you're saying that you don't have a duty here, the amended pleading adds a negligent undertaking claim to say, well, you assume the duty. Well, if your summary judgment motion also addressed the element of causation or damages, those are both common to the negligent undertaking. So even if they can say, well, you had a duty under negligent undertaking, you've still addressed another element.
Sure. We already talked about how the rule is now addressing late filed evidence. So I don't think we need to spend any more time on that. I think as a sort of a final point on, and I wouldn't say that it's really an issue created by the new rule. It's just more of an observation. The initial draft frequently used the term adverse party throughout the rule. And what the court did, I think, is a good change here. They removed all the references to adverse party and changed it to non-movement, which is consistent with what we commonly see in the case law, movement versus a non-movement. I've never seen a summary judgment case using the phrase adverse party, at least not in the context of someone who is otherwise a non-movement. So that, I think that's, it's minor, but it's just worth pointing out, I think.
Yeah, that's a good change.
Okay, so let's talk about what are the practical implications here. We've talked about some of them. We've talked about docket control orders are going to probably be changed, need to be changed. Some things that we mentioned in the last episode where we covered the previous version of this, where, you know, we've got a lot of things in here that courts are going to have to jump on and get used to, but it's kind of reminiscent of the TCPA and what the courts had to go through and dealing with deadlines to rule that statute. And I think our conclusion at the time was they did it before with the TCPA. They'll figure it out when it comes to new Rule 166A2. It's probably worth mentioning again briefly that the timelines for ruling and so forth are going to be reported to the OCA. This was all tied up in some statutes where I guess the legislature decided that the judges weren't rightly or wrongly getting things done and working hard enough to get motions disposed of. So, you know, that's something to keep an eye on too, is what the OCA stats ultimately reveal on some of this, but that's not really a practice implication. I think we got Mike here to offer us a little different perspective. So let me throw it over to you, Mike. You know, what are some of the practical implications for practitioners on both the movement and the non-movement side that we really haven't had a chance to get into yet that you've thought of that you'd like to discuss?
Sure. One of the practical implications that I've seen a few times, I don't think this is all that common, but I have seen it a couple of times. Some people have been filing Rule 91A motions that have as an alternative a motion for summary judgment. And of course, if you've got a 91A motion, that 91A motion has to be heard sometime the 21st day and the 45th day after it was filed. And it's got to be decided on by the 45th day. And now we've got motions for summary judgment that have a window of the 35th day and the 60th day after they've been filed to be heard. And if you file this combination motion, you're putting the court in a box where they've got a 10-day time window in which they need to hear and decide at least the 91A portion of the motion, not to mention that the respondents' deadlines are, in the case of the 91A motion, 7 days prior to hearing, and in the case of the summary judgment, 21 days after filing. So I think probably best way to deal with that is to avoid filing these combination motions. And if you're on the receiving end of one, you might want to object to it or go ahead and file separate responses.
Yeah, that's an interesting combination. And of course, you know, the skeptics out there might say, why in the world would a lawyer billing by the hour choose to combine two motions into one when you can prepare two and bill for two? But there's, as you pointed out, there's a good reason not to do it that way. One of the biggest reasons is not to, as you say, Mike, put the court in a box. The court might set a hearing on the 91A part and not on the MSJ part, I suppose, would be one way of dealing with that. The court could just treat them like separate motions. But why even go there? Why do you even need to do that? I guess the practical advice is, to those of you who have done that, unless you've got a strategic reason for doing it, don't do it. And what's the strategic reason? It's just better if you don't.
Beyond that, the practical implications are, and most of these are the legislature's implications, not the Supreme Court's changes. I'll say 3/4 of them are the legislature's implications. And that's that we now have 4 different categories of summary judgment rules that apply to summary judgments that are out there in the world that have been filed. If you filed your summary judgment before August 31st, it is entirely under the old rules and the new statutes don't apply at all. If you filed it between September 1 and December 30th, it is under statute that was passed as SB 293. That can sit out there just like an old summary judgment can, because it does not have to have a hearing until 45 days after a response is filed. And the court doesn't have to rule on it until 90 days after the hearing. So if you don't set it for a hearing, the non-movement never files a response. You know, it can last out there like summary judgments used to. It does raise an issue of that I haven't fully wrapped my head around, of if you're the non-movement and you want to get that summary judgment out of the way, can you just file a response and force a hearing?
It is. I have another question, but I want you to finish your point on the 3 different versions.
So then category 4 is the motions that were filed after December 4th, or on December 4th and after, but before March. And those now have the new deadlines for the court to hear the summary judgment within 60 or 90 days and to rule on it within 90 days. But the response deadline and reply deadline are the same as they used to be. Respond 7 days before hearing and reply. Well, you know, if there's a local rule, maybe you have to file a reply in a timely way. Otherwise, I know people who have filed their replies after the hearing.
Why?
I know. And then the 4th category is the only one that the court's really responsible for here. And that's the new one. That's all of the court's deadlines according to the legislature's edict, and then the new deadlines for response and reply that line up with the federal court response and reply deadlines.
So we have those middle 2 categories of motions. If you see this episode or listen to it, you might want to pull up Michael's chart and look at it during this part of, when you're listening to this part of the discussion, or at least do it immediately after. Illustrates, he's got the wonderful, almost spreadsheet looking chart that lays all this out for you, including the deadlines, the times for ruling, everything, and with hyperlinks and everything in it. So again, I really do, first of all, commend you, Michael, for putting this together and sharing it publicly and for allowing us to share it publicly, because I think it's going to keep a lot of lawyers out of trouble. But in looking at that middle 2, you know, you've got the 4 different categories you mentioned, not 3 that I said earlier. Those middle 2 categories are sort of the no man's land of summary judgment practice right now. And, you know, just in terms of thinking about practical solutions and maybe making the court's job easier, making it easier on the parties even in some ways, what's to keep, I guess strategically this would depend on which side the party falls on, but it seems like you could avoid having to deal with these sort of gaps by just withdrawing and refiling your motion. Just try to put it, you want to put it into the new rule completely, may or may not please the court. I don't know. But if you're not going to follow under the old rule, if you're in that gap, if you're in those middle two categories, I mean, would it be a practical solution to the head scratcher of what rules apply and how does this work? Just withdraw your motion and refile it?
You could certainly do that. One thing that I know one of my partners encountered was she had a hearing on a summary judgment motion. I believe it was in December after the December rules took place, but it was summary judgment that was filed before that, of course. And the judge asked to go on the record at the hearing for the sole purpose of getting the counsel on both sides to agree as to when the summary judgment was filed and what rules applied to her decision-making and whether or not she had a deadline by which she needed to rule according to the rules that applied.
I like that. And that's a good solution to things from the court's perspective. That on a related point, I was also thinking, in addition to the parties potentially withdrawing and refiling a motion, I don't know that the court really could practically order the parties to do that. But what you're saying about this hearing that went forward was that was almost the net effect of it. Is so, you know, the court could have it locked in on what rules actually did apply. Maybe could the parties agree that the process be handled under the new Rule 166A?
I suppose they could agree to that. I'm not entirely positive. That's a tough one.
I'll refer back to my earlier reference to spitballing because that's all we're really doing at this point. And I just wish there was there's a category of cases where summary judgment motions were filed after August 31 and before March 1st. They're just bizarre. It's going to take a while for those to work their way through the system. And so if there's not any prejudice to the parties, why not come up with some kind of creative solution where you know what rules apply, the court knows what it needs to do, nobody's overburdened by any of this, I would think. I don't know. It's just me trying to be practical. And you've given a lot of great practical advice already, Mike, just thinking out loud, seeing if we could come up with any other solutions that would be helpful to parties in the court.
One practical rule that the Supreme Court could make might be that any summary judgments filed on or before February 28th, but not decided by some date that they set in the future, are automatically denied without prejudice on that date. And that would force anybody who has an outstanding summary judgment, if they want to get it heard, to refile it under the new rules.
It may come to that at some point. I don't know. What if some of these are just sitting out there forever and nobody bothers to set them? And it just...
Well, you know, that's the way it's always been.
I think we're going to see some mandamus practice coming out of this. At the end of it, I recognize that there's now these accountability statistics and some judicial discipline. But under the text of this rule, there's not really a specific consequence to a trial judge that doesn't rule by the date. It's not overruled by operation of law. It's not, it just is there. And if you don't rule in time, you can get in trouble, but it doesn't have any actual impact on the court itself or the parties or the suit or anything, which is not a bad thing, but maybe there's something to that.
Yeah. Eventually you'll have these rolling out as cases settle or go to trial. But as you guys know, sometimes that can be years down the road.
But, you know, now that there's a hard deadline for a ruling, in the past, there have been mandamuses when judges fail to rule on certain types of motions. And now that there's both a statutory and a rule-based one, I just wonder if we're going to see parties starting to use that. Although it's a dangerous game, as Todd and I have talked about before, because guess what your ruling's going to be if you force a judge to make it? But, I mean, sometimes you do need it, especially if it's like a summary judgment that can trigger an interlocutory appeal. I mean, good or bad, sometimes you just need a ruling. I do understand that.
Yeah, that's right. As we start winding down here, Michael, I did want to give you the opportunity to tell our listeners and viewers anything else you wanted to tell them about the chart. I just think, again, you were so gracious. You shared it on LinkedIn. And I was curious, one, what kind of response you've had to it, because I think it's extremely useful, as I said, but you got it basically all figured out. All the hard thinking is done.
The chart really started back with that summary judgment hearing that I talked about, where the judge asked the attorneys to go on the record. It was at that point that I said, yeah, well, we've got the time, three different categories of summary judgments that are out there. And I sat down and sort of mapped them out. I didn't make it as clean a chart as this. But then in February, when some of my partners were discussing the new summary judgment rules, and it was clear there was still some confusion about what rules applied, I thought, well, I've already got this all written down. I bet I can put it in a format people will be able to see. once I did that, I circulated within the firm and everybody received it really well there. And I thought, well, you know what? I should just share this because this is something that should benefit people. And really, you want your opposing counsel to know the rules as well as you do, because you do not want to have to deal with trying to explain to the court how you're right and they're not.
That's exactly right. Especially when it's, you know, statutory type deadlines and those things. So
yeah, that's how I came up with it. And I just tried to put into it everything I could fit on a single page that one needed to know about.
Like a law school cheat sheet.
Exactly. Because it's something I've now got it taped on my wall.
Right beside my desk. I was just going to say, practitioners, print this out and tape it to your wall.
Take it with you to your summary judgment hearings for the next foreseeable future till we get some more stuff figured out. Well, Mike, this has been great, and we really appreciate having the chart and everything. As we wrap up, our tradition is to ask for a tip or war story. Have you got anything for us on either one of those? You've already given us lots of tips, but we'll take more.
I do. I have actually a war story that I thought of while we were here. And it's one that, because there are a lot of appellate practitioners who listen to this, they probably have heard this story before from Chad Baruch, from his perspective. But it occurred while I was clerking at the Supreme Court. And as you know, at the Supreme Court, they usually start oral arguments at 9 a.m. And they warn you in advance, a case is not going to take a full hour. So if you're one of the second or third to bring your case, don't wait till 10 a.m. or 11 a.m. to show up in the courtroom, because your case might be starting without you. Well, I was acting as the marshal for the court that day, and Chad was one of the party's counsels, and the other party's counsel had gone down to the Texas Law Library to read over his notes before his argument. And when you're the marshal, the court has a switch in the cloaking room that they can turn on, and that turns on a little light at the marshal's desk that shows you that the court is about to come into the courtroom. You stand up and holler, "All rise." Well, that light went on and there was nobody at counsel's table. The light is actually a lighted light switch, and I didn't know if it was two-way or not, but I'm desperately flipping it off and on, trying to signal to the roaming room that they are not ready
argument.
But the court came out, took their seats, and they sat there for about 3 minutes, just staring at Chad at his counsel table, while Blake went running down to the library to find counsel.
I'm just glad it wasn't Chad.
Yeah. Oh, Chad would know not to do that.
Yeah, I know.
I guess the lesson there is might as well sit through the arguments before yours, because you don't know when you're going to get reached.
Great point. Well, thanks for that, Mike. I do want to mention, we'll put a link to a miscellaneous docket number 26-9012, which is the red line version of the final rule 166A. We'll put a link to your chart. And by the way, to the point of the rule, a full set of the new rules of Texas Rules of Civil Procedure and Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure that are currently effective are available on the Supreme Court's website. So you can get the most recent rule, I believe, complete set of them just by going to the Supreme Court site and downloading them, and you get a full PDF of the entire schmear. I do think it's helpful to look at the red line personally and see what the court did. And just also as a reminder, this is sort of part two from episode 160. If anything you heard here today doesn't make any sense at all to you, maybe go back and listen to that episode and you'll see where Jody and I were coming from. So Mike, thanks again for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your colleagues and rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. To connect with us, suggest a topic, or inquire about being a guest, visit texapplawpod.com or find us on LinkedIn and X at texapplawpod. Produced and powered by Law Pods. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.